Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for coming to this briefing on the work towards a global code of conduct for foreign exchange markets. From my left to my right are Chris Salmon, the Executive Director for Markets here at the Bank of England, Guy De Bell, the Assistant Governor at the Reserve Bank of Australia and Chair of the BIS Markets Committee, David Puth, Chief Executive of CLS, the FX Settlement Service, and finally, Simon Potter, an Executive Vice President of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. We have an hour and are on the record throughout. An audio recording we've made available on the RBA website after the briefing, hence we're wired up. So we'll kick off with some opening remarks from Guy and then from David, and then open up for your Q&A. So with that, I'll hand over to Guy.
Okay, thanks very much, and thanks everyone for coming along. Why are we doing this now, this press briefing? One is simply the fact that I actually happen to be in town, but also that this work has been underway now for a few months, but we had our first meeting with the market participants group, which I'll explain what that is in a second, yesterday. Which is involving the private sector participants in this work. And then, so on the back of that, and the fact that we had all four of us in the one place at the one time, and given we're in London, we thought it appropriate to provide details or more information about what we're doing, and just to give everyone here an understanding of what the work is about. So, as I said, it's not that we've only just started, it's just the fact that we all happen to be in the one place at the one time, and particularly being in London at the one time. So let me talk a bit about what this work is about, also talk a bit about how we got here, where we've come from, talk a bit about what we're aiming to do over the next 18 months or so, and then what where things go from there. So this work to come up with a global code of conduct for the FX industry, we were tasked by that by the BIS governors back in May. There are two things which I think are worth emphasising. One, it's a single code of conduct for the whole industry. So at the moment, in the major financial centres, there are around about a half a dozen codes of conduct. Ourselves in Australia and the ECB use the ACI code. There's a separate one in New York, Japan, London, Singapore, and Hong Kong. The Canadians don't have a code of conduct at all. So there's a diversity across those codes. They have a reasonable amount of similarities, as I'll come to in a minute. But one of the main aims of this is to consolidate, to have one for the whole industry, particularly given the FX obviously is a global industry. It makes sense to have one single code. I'd also emphasize the word global. So the constituency of our group is very much global. We encompasses the 15 largest financial centres in the world. So in addition to some of the countries I just mentioned, we have representation from Brazil, Mexico, India. And the full list is on the BIS website, both on the central banking side and on the market participant side. So I think the two important aspects are, one, this is a single code for the whole industry, and secondly, it's a global code. It also is intended to cover the whole gamut of the industry. So this is not a code of conduct for the sell side, for instance. It is it is there for the sell side, the buy side, for platforms and other market participants. So it is, its breadth is both across the globe, but also across the whole structure of the foreign exchange industry. The way we are aiming to take this work forward is, and to explain the roles of the three gentlemen who are sitting up here with me, we have, as I said, there are those existing codes out there. We are not going to try and reinvent the wheel on these codes. We are going to try and build on what's already there. And so one of the tasks we are doing is harmonizing the existing codes. There is a lot of commonality across them. A lot of the language is actually pretty reasonable. And so there's no point in trying to reinvent that. So one of the aspects of the work is harmonizing those existing codes, and that work has actually been underway for a while. the work on sort of producing the code is being led by Simon. And so in addition to the harmonising part, we realise, and particularly given events which have happened over the last few years, that there are obviously some gaps in those codes. And so we're not just harmonising the existing codes. We have identified gaps which clearly need filling, and particularly spending a fair bit of time explaining what we regard as good practice and what we regard as bad practice. That will be in the code. So one of the comments which has come up over the last few years is that there was a lack of clarity or lack of understanding about what was appropriate practice and what wasn't. So one of our aims is to try and remedy that lack of understanding by providing guidance around that. To assist us in coming up with that language, we have a group of market participants, around 25 to 30 of them, again, across the whole spectrum of the industry and across the whole globe. So we have people from the sell side, people from the buy side, people from platforms, corporates who are involved in the FX industry, and from right across the globe, roughly one or two per the 15 jurisdictions that I'm in, that are on the group. And David has very generously agreed to chair that work. So we are looking for input on, particularly on some of the gaps in the existing codes from those market participants. As part of the remediation process that a number of them have gone through, they have spent a lot of time over the last while reforming their own internal codes, and are probably going to, our expectation is it covers off on some of the gaps that we are looking to fill in the global code. So we will try and basically take the best of what's there and put that into the global code. So David is leading that group of market participants. And then it's all very nice having a code, but it's not that useful if no one actually follows it. If we look at what the existing codes out there, as I said, they're actually reasonable. There are clearly some gaps in them, but they're actually not that bad. But clearly, there was a lack of adherence or following of those codes. And so, as well as coming up with that single global code, we have also been tasked with coming up with mechanisms to achieve greater adherence to that code. And that work is being led by Chris. So as I said, there are effectively two streams to our work. The one is coming up with a new code, and the second one is coming up with mechanisms to get people to actually follow that code, which clearly there has been a reasonable deficiency on. This work hasn't starting from scratch. As a number of you may be aware, the various foreign exchange committees, particularly from the eight largest market centres, have been working together now for a little while in a constructive fashion. And earlier this year, we put out the global preamble, which basically had it was about four or five pages, which had some content around appropriate information sharing and about some appropriate practices in the market. So that had taken, we'd put that together over the previous 12 months or so. So it actually showed that we can actually work together, which is not a given. And so this work actually is building on that work, which was already underway. And at the previous Global Foreign Exchange Committee meeting in Tokyo early this year, we'd already started work on harmonising the codes. And so when the BIS governance tasked us with this task in May, that work was already underway. So it's very much building on the work and the structure which is already in place. As you probably know, the foreign exchange committees are comprised of both the central banks provide, and varies across the jurisdictions, but either certainly provide support and or chair the various foreign exchange committees, but they're primarily composed of private sector participants in each of those markets. So that is very much a joint initiative between the central banks and the private sector. The work we are doing here is very much that as well. It is the central banks working with the private sector to get the foreign exchange industry into a better place. So as I said, we are very much building on that work which is already underway. So this is, again, not starting from scratch, but building on what's there. In terms of the timeline, we are aiming to have this work done by May 2017, but we're not going away and locking ourselves in a room for 18 months and then appearing like Moses from the mountain with a bunch of commandments and saying, here we are. We're aiming to make this work is actually going to be pretty public throughout. One of the things we're intending to do is, certainly by May next year, is put up some material, particularly on some of those topics which are not covered in the existing codes, and put that out there. So that everyone can see that, as I said, including some of the more contentious or topics in the industry at the moment. So around, say, stop loss, around how do you act as principal versus agent. So the material around that. So in a sense, we're putting out the code in chunks rather than waiting until we've got the whole thing in May 2017, so that people are able to react to that. Throughout the process, we will, in the end, we need to get all the foreign exchange committees and their members to sign up to this thing. And so throughout the process, we'll be looking for input from them. And the role of the private sector members on David's group is to serve as a point of contact for the private sector in their various jurisdictions. So again, we are looking for input and feedback from the market as we go, because again, there's no point in having something which is going to be unworkable, and people are going to say, well, that's no, I can't follow that, that's no good. So as I said, we will have some, the aim is to have output, visible output in May 2016, but to be finished, or have a, finished is not quite the right word, but have the single code out there in May 2017, along with proposals around the adherence mechanisms. We're also not, come May 2017, we're not done and dusted. The industry will continue to evolve, the market structure will continue to evolve. The idea is that this code will continue to evolve through time. We've got to do a little more thinking about the mechanism by which to achieve that. But as I said, it's not like we're just going to come up and say, okay, here's a code, our work is done. It's going to have to keep on evolving through time. In terms of what success for the project would be, beyond coming up for a code, I think would be that we can actually achieve widespread adherence to the code, and also adherence that is observable across the market and to people like yourselves, as well as to all market participants, because there clearly needs to be a significant rebuilding of confidence in the way that this market functions. So that would be success, was that people would be signing up to this code, and also obviously the absence of examples of widespread divergences from the good practices that is going to be contained in the code. As I said, that's the basic structure. We are looking to come up with a single code, build on what's there, harmonise the existing codes. But we have one code which is there across the global market and across all aspects of the market, as well as achieve much greater adherence to the code than clearly has been the case in the past. So let me stop there by way of introduction and just turn to David to say a few more words about the market participants group.
Great. Thank you very much, Guy, and thank you all for coming today. We appreciate it. We had a very, what we would consider a successful kickoff day yesterday with the Market Practitioners Group, the Market Participants Group, along with the FXWG. Let me just highlight a couple of key elements that may be part of the questions that would come later. But a number of people said, why now? Why are you addressing this issue now? We have in the foreign exchange market the largest and most liquid market in the world. It operates 24 hours a day for 5.5 days a week from the start of New Zealand until the close in New York. We tried to put away all parochial issues as we went through our committee, but to the close in New York, you can get a price in most major and many minor currencies. You've got a very big market with a great number of participants that has functioned successfully for many, many years. Some things have changed, notably the evolution of market practices over the last several years as a result of two, I think, very dynamic elements, one being the growth in electronic platforms that has brought in a whole new set of participants and practices to the market that weren't part of what had originally been conceived in the marketplace. And second, the change in regulation that followed some of the events of 2008 have caused market participants to change some of their behaviors in a very positive direction, but has changed the way the markets have operated and interacted with one another. And then lastly, some of the events that Guy referenced over the last several years brought to our attention the need to say a global code would be most effective and most needed at this point in time. The goal of the MPG is not, in fact, to write the code itself, but to help work with and advise the FXWG, the group of central bankers, to provide some market insight in terms of what's working and what is not working, to help coordinate best practices, and also to report back to each of the regional committees where possible to help ensure that adherence to the practices once we put them in place is something that's universal and accepted around the globe. We have, as Guy highlighted, a very, very strong group of market participants that represent the wholesale market in every way. I have corporations, we have strong buy-side financial institutions, and we have a number of banks as well as electronic platforms represented. And we think the group, which doesn't come representing any given single institution, but rather strong representatives from the marketplace who are coming to represent the market and the various regions around the world to talk about how we can make the market function more effectively than it has in the past. Again, we have a very strong market today. We want to make it stronger tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So with that, the panel will be very happy to take your questions. Please state your name and organization before asking, and please keep your questions relevant to the work of the FX Global Code. With that, Hugh, go ahead.
Yeah,
thank you.
Jones, Reuters. I mean, the key thing is adherence, isn't it? What do you foresee in the adherence? Do you foresee criminal sanctions, civil sanctions, banning from industry? I mean, where's the teeth in all this?
Well, they can't answer that question yet because we've actually got to work it. We've got to come up with the answer to that question ourselves. Let me just say one thing, though. So we are, in most cases, as central banks, we are not regulators. So we can propose, a number of the adherence mechanisms we're going to propose are going to be within the market. So, but some of them might not necessarily be so. The other thing we've got to bear in mind is with 15 currency zones, and including and with the euro area of a few more countries, there are different regulatory regimes in each of those with different degrees of coverage of the foreign exchange market. So we've got to be mindful of that. But you're right. I mean, the adherence, I think, is actually our biggest challenge because, you know, coming together and writing a code is a logistical challenge, but that's what it is. And I have reasonable confidence that we can do that. But that's effectively a drafting and, you know, and I said logistical challenge. The adherence one is more of an intellectual challenge, and I think is the greatest challenge that we face. So, as I said, I can't answer your question today. I hope at some point, either certainly by May 2017 and hopefully a bit before, I will be able to answer your question. But, I mean, the question, you know, we will consider all of those things that you mentioned, but we can only propose things in some circumstances because we don't, as given who we are, necessarily have the power to implement that. But I might get Chris to pick up on that a bit.
Sure. So the way you answered your question, Hugh, was adherence through criminal sanctions and legal regimes. I think one of the issues, or where we will centre a lot of our work, is focusing on what you can do within the marketplace before you get to that place, and that's to do with issues to do with embedding codes properly in firm systems and controls, creating transparency so people can monitor or demonstrate whether they're adhering to a code, and then thinking about what the market-based incentives are to create stronger incentives for firms to adhere to the code. So it's a bunch of stuff you can do before you get to legal regimes, and one of the things we'll need to do is to work through those set of issues and ultimately form judgments about the strength of the incentives that we can create through those types of mechanisms.
I think I would add that there's a highly motivated group of market practitioners who have viewed the events of the last several years as something that has caused them to recognize the need that for the market to change. And when you have motivated participants who seek to adhere to the code, my sense is it will work itself out in the correct way.
Yes, please go ahead. Thank you.
Joel Bell, freelance, the writer for Financial News. Guy, you talked about gaps in the code, in the existing codes. Can you just give a flavour of kind of the top two or three things that need to be addressed? And also, just to clarify, when this code is finalised in May 2017, does that mean all the other 12 codes that you mentioned will cease to be, or will they continue to exist in some way?
Yeah, two good questions. So I mentioned some of the gaps. So, I mean, one which I think, one obvious one is how you trade as principal versus how you trade as agent. And to some extent, once you answer that one, a whole bunch of other stuff flows from that. So that is one clear gap, and that's one clear area where there is a lack of clarity in the marketplace at the moment as to how to trade in those two things. But then if I go slightly down from that, another thing would be stop loss, which obviously got picked up a bit in the FEMA process. General issues around order handling, you know, partial fills. Another one which is certainly popular in this jurisdiction, timestamps. So there are sort of three or four. Simon, do you want to?
There's last look as well.
Oh, last look, thank you, yes. You know, I suppose to some extent the issues which have been at the fore over the last little while, I mean, to some extent we set ourselves a challenge of trying to address them sooner rather than later, in part because if we're able to put that material out by sort of May next year, we can start providing that clarity and changing behaviour or providing a benchmark for appropriate behaviour sooner rather than later on some of those things. In terms of the existing codes, yes, that is the aim. Obviously, I mean, and we've spent a fair bit of time looking at what's in the existing codes, and it turns out a lot of them have a lot of similarity. There are a few, and I'd emphasise the word few, local conditions which still need to be there. And so we would envisage having local annexes which are short, which would address particular idiosyncrasies, like whether the market starts in Sydney time or Auckland time. But they would be very much around local conditions, and the bulk of the code would be in the global code. But we've obviously got to recognise that there are a few local idiosyncrasies which need still to be there. But I would envisage that they would be pretty short. But yes, they will be. The existing codes out there would be subsumed into this global code.
And some of the codes have best practices separate from FX. So in those areas, they'll have to work out when they adopt the global code for FX, how they deal with other products. That'll be an issue in the UK with the NIPS code.
Yeah, and in Hong Kong as well. Yeah.
There's a last issue on this that I think is very relevant. Given that we are trying to apply the code to a wide number of countries around the world, clearly there will be specific issues relative to markets, notably where there are controlled currencies, where there will most likely be annexes associated with the overriding global code. So it wouldn't be unusual for one to see an addition to the global code in a local market to address those specific issues.
Great, thank you. Go ahead.
So firstly, are you envisaging this ever extending beyond the 15 countries that are currently being looked at? And secondly, can you talk a bit more about some of the challenges related to harmonizing those?
The answer to your first question is yes. And so, for instance, in my part of the world, Asia, that is, I've been, you know, there are a number of countries, sort of smaller markets than the 15 who are involved, and we're sort of very much keeping them in the loop on that. I mean, I can't, you know, same in Latin America, same in Scandinavia. So, yes, it's not. The group we've got working on this is comprised of the 15 largest currencies, or FX markets in the world. But yes, it's certainly there at the minimum as a guidepost for those other markets. But a number of them expressed quite keen interest in, once it's there, that they would then intend to adopt it. themselves as well. Now, I've forgotten the second part of your question. I'm sorry.
Sorry, it was just a bit more about the challenges of harmonising.
Oh, yeah. So it turns out, well, I don't want to understate it, but it's not quite. It turns out the codes are much more similar than you think. There are differences. Simon's group has put together this massive spreadsheet, which goes through line by, not quite line by line, but section by section, and compares and contrasts. And it turns out there's much more similarity than differences. So as I said, it's a logistical challenge, but I suppose I wouldn't completely overstate it.
So I'd say the hard part is not to produce a code that's this high.
Yeah.
And if you harmonize across six different codes, you could produce that. So we're trying to keep the code as succinct and clear as possible, so it's relevant and then used, and it's easy for people to use.
Yeah.
That's part of how we'll get the embedding that Chris talked about, and hopefully more consistent behavior with the code.
Yeah. I mean, so that is the challenge, is very much to make the thing readable and to actually have content. So it's not one of these things by the time you have drafting from 15 different countries and market participants and their lawyers that you end up with something which has no content whatsoever or is the lowest common denominator. The aim is not the lowest common denominator, the aim is the highest common denominator. So it's taking the best of rather than the lowest. It's a challenge, but I think to some extent I think that's a very manageable challenge.
That's in the background.
Yeah, that's the thing from
Do you encounter regulatory arbitrage when you did your assessment of the market, and how do you plan to deal with this problem in the market?
Well,
I'm not sure I would describe the source of the problem as regulatory arbitrage. And so, the codes were codes, and not necessarily regulation. There was some confusion in terms of things being described in different ways in the different codes, but as I said, there are much more similarities than differences. I wouldn't attribute that as the major source of the problem. But in the end, and this is something the market has been asking for, if we just have one single code, then it's very clear what that is. And it certainly would remove that as any potential source of confusion. I wouldn't attribute much of what happened to being caused by that. But.
Yeah, I would add, we saw very little evidence of that. There are certainly countries where practices may be slightly different, but they're not driven by regulation.
Okay, Chiara.
Thanks, Alex. Chiara Mendes from the Wall Street Journal. Now, this is a very clear big commitment, a global one. For effects. Why effects only, and are you planning to extend the same code to other asset classes?
The background, as I said, is we're all on foreign exchange committees, so effects is, and to some extent, that's where the central banks have historically played that role, and so that's why we're doing it for effects. We're mindful there is other work going on through the FSB in terms of general codes of conduct for the market as a whole, which would encompass those other asset classes. But, as I said, our involvement very much stems from our participation in FX committees, which has got a long historical background, and that's why we're doing what we're doing, I suppose.
A slightly trite response to your question would be FX is uniquely global, and that's why we need a global initiative for it. In the UK context, you think about FEMA recommendations, the whole point of establishing the FIC market standards body was to think about mechanisms to improve standards across the FIC markets as a whole. And one of the things FMSB has said is it will look to work cooperatively with international kind of colleagues as it takes forward its initiatives.
Okay, in the second round.
Given what you just said about the codes being fairly simple and there being more similarities than differences, given the urgency of sorting out this market, why is it taking you till May 2017 to come up with the code? To lots of people, that might seem like quite a long time.
I don't know if you've ever tried to work with 15 jurisdictions. I think most people would. I have other people who said that's an extremely ambitious timetable. So I suppose it depends from where you start. But that's part of what I said about getting stuff out sooner rather than later, particularly on some of those those identified gaps, is to try and, there is a pressing need for this, and so we are trying to do it as quickly as possible. I'd also like to point out that all of us have day jobs, both on the central banking side and on the market participant side, and so this is my night job. I think it's, I also wouldn't understate the logistical challenge of trying to pull this together. We also have to we have to get something which people are going to be willing to sign up to, which means they have to have some input into the process, and just managing that process, just takes time. But as I said, the aim is to have a complete thing by May 2017, as you said, but the aim is also to put out significant content well ahead of that, including sometime around about May next year.
So I'd add that we've been doing things like this for a long time, so we have a pretty good estimate of how long it takes to do this well, and we've tried to add resources, streamline as much as possible to hit that date. That is still a tough date to hit, and there's been a lot of work done in the last 4 months to ensure that we do hit that date.
Another way of answering your question is don't underestimate how important this initiative is viewed by our governors who remitted this to us, or by the industry who's come together through the market practitioners group. So this is an ambitious timetable, and it's viewed as a really very important initiative which aims to be impactful.
And I suppose the aim is also to get it right. As I said, we'll continue to evolve past that date, but we want to have something which is effective from the get-go. As I said, it will evolve beyond that, but rather than rush out with something which may not be so effective.
Okay, Tim.
Two more to the Telegraph. How are you going to judge if this is a success? Will there be no more scandals, or will you catch the bad guys quicker? How's it going to work?
I'll get Chris to ask it as well, but to some extent, if the thing's working, then things should be flushed out. So the complete absence of poor behaviour, I don't think it would be the identification of the poor behaviour sooner rather than later would be one measure of success, I would think. You can't eradicate poor behaviour in any aspect of life, really, in particular market as much as anything. So I don't think we can regard that as the goal, but if this process is working, that poor behaviour should be identified sooner rather than later and flushed out into the open. I think another metric of success would basically be improved confidence within the industry. There is a fairly clear lack of confidence in the industry, and lack of trust, and given financial markets ultimately need to rely on trust to function effectively, the absence of that trust is impairing the effective functioning of the market. So an improvement in that, I think, would be another metric of success. Chris?
I don't think I really have anything to add to what Guy said or what he said in his opening remarks, but this will be a process. We create the Global Code in two stages, 2016, 2017. It gets widespread endorsement and acceptance across all of the markets which are represented, and firms adjust their behaviours where appropriate and necessary to abide by the code, so that there is widespread adherence and confidence rebuilds. But that will take time, and that's understandably.
In the second row, you've got a question.
Yes, you mentioned adherence to the code, but will you be providing suggestions in terms of how to comply with the code within the firms themselves? Because that is
yes.
A big issue. It's
yes.
Adherence to the other ones.
Yes. No. Definitely. That is certainly. That will certainly be something we will be doing. So yes, is the answer to your question.
Okay. Scott.
Hi. Sorry. Do you mind if I ask two questions, Scott? I'm also
sure.
First of all, can you just elaborate a bit more on what the significant output will be next year? You say May 2016.
Yep.
Sorry. You may have said this earlier. Would that include how you think it might be enforced, the code of conduct? And then also the second question is, how much of a challenge is it to make sure that all this doesn't have too much of an adverse impact on liquidity? How are you going to incorporate that into your code?
credit this, one of my favourite topics. On the first, we would definitely be putting out content, as I said, around some of the topics when I answered the question over here earlier. Would be around principal agent, stop loss, last look. So there'd be content around some of that and some other, without denigrating it, slightly more mundane content, but content nevertheless. So we have a reasonable idea of what that would be. It would be a reasonable chunk of the code. It may need to evolve in the sense that once we've got the whole document in front of us, we may need to move it around a bit, but there'd be around some of those sort of more high-profile issues. On the adherence side, again, I think that would take... may not be able to answer that question now in the sense that we have to see how that goes. So the answer is possibly, but I'm not sure I could commit to that. As that... The idea is to get it out there when we think it's appropriate to get it out there. But again, we don't want to put it out there sooner rather than later. In terms of liquidity, to some extent, I'm not sure there's a direct correlation between appropriate behaviour and liquidity in the market. There will be some content around, what are appropriate obligations of participants in the market, which I would think would potentially have the outcome of improving market liquidity, or at least confidence in the liquidity in the market.
I would concur, and that was certainly part of our discussion yesterday. I think one of the clear goals of the process is to improve the effectiveness and the efficiency of the market, and I think by its given nature, it will drive liquidity in the market. Clarity of roles will bring out different levels of commercial interests from not just banks but other participants in the marketplace. This definition of principal and agent and how that will work, I think at the end it will improve liquidity in the market as there will be a greater clarity of roles.
Katharina with Handelsblatt, German Business Daily. Could you give one or two examples for differences between the different code of conducts? And what is the guiding principle for you when you are going to consolidate it?
I might turn to Simon to answer on the Z notes.
So I think the major difference is some of the codes are very sell-side codes. And if you look at some of what we've done in New York over the last few years, if we've involved the buy-side more, and it's more directed at all market participants. So some of what we're trying to do in the single code is make sure that in all jurisdictions, it's focused on all of the market participants. And you can go to the New York FXC's website. You can see that we have a range of different documents which we've been trying to rationalize over the last 2 years. And that sort of represents a history as the industry has changed. We've been adding best practices for various groups within the industry. Part of what we're trying to do with this single code is just have this one location for all market participants to go. And that's capturing how integrated they are. So sometimes it's hard to tell really whether a buy-side firm is acting a little bit like a sell-side firm. We have the new platforms. So we're adapting. This is what have happened naturally, I think, in each of the areas. Adapting each of the codes for the changes we've seen in the FX market as well.
Patrick Graham from Reuters. Just following on from that, it just occurred to me that in a way that you seem to be suggesting that everything we've had up today, and this is obviously the bank's argument, has focused very much on the sell side and sort of legal stuff as well. Does that mean that you think there's more to come out or more to say about how the buy side behave in FX markets than previously has done? And secondly, just on a small point, previously, of course, the work on the sort of last round of FX code stuff was done was led by the ECB, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. Why has that changed?
Roberto Schiappi, who's also on our group. I mean, through the global FXC process, we just sort of, at different times, different people are leading different works. But also, so this work was also tasked to the Markets Committee, which I happen to be the chair of. But so, I mean, it was a, so hence slight change, but I mean, we've got the same participation from everyone that we've had in the past on that one. On the appropriate behaviours, I mean, as I said, we're trying to just provide guidance on appropriate behaviour for all participants in the market. So it's not saying that there's necessarily a shortcoming.
So you haven't talked about the benchmark work that you led yet. Maybe it's a good example of some of this interplay.
Yeah, I mean, so the FX, the FX benchmark stuff that we put out last September around recommendations for reform, I mean, that focused on all aspects of the market. So it wasn't just directed at the sell side, even though, I mean, they're the ones who have been where the cases have emerged. But, you know, there were opportunities for improvement across all aspects of the market. So we made recommendations around for WM itself, the sell side, the buy side, index providers, central banks even. So, you know, I mean, I think, as Simon was alluding to earlier, you know, the market structure has changed, the different roles, you know, the clean separation between the different parts of the market isn't quite there today as it might have been in the past. So roles are changing, nature of participation is changing, and I think we've just got to, you know, that's the reality of the current structure of the market, and we've got to be cognizant of that.
So it used to be a dealer-to-dealer market a lot, and there's much less of that. So in the triennial that the BIS did in 2013, you saw a growth in a trend of many more market participants trading, and that's a really big change, and we have to reflect that in the code.
I think that's probably the biggest issue, the evolution of the market, that where lines are blurred about who is a price maker and who is a price taker, the rapid growth of high-frequency trading and the contribution of that high-frequency trading makes to the liquidity of the market, large financial institutions on the sell side that will put prices into the market, an entirely different market than it was as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, when it was really the dealers were the only ones making prices to the market. And that evolution is one that we're very cognizant of, and I think has been addressed in a reasonably positive way, as Simon said, by adding buy-side participants to certain committees, but also very much referring back to our goal here with the single global code, that this is a single global code to apply to all wholesale participants and not driven so primarily to the sell side, but to the buy side, inclusive of corporates and other areas as well.
And platforms.
Yeah.
Any other questions? In the back row. Yes, please.
Hey, Philip Hinton from The Guardian. I just wanted to bring the conversation back to sanctions. And Mr. Friedman, have you given us a clue as to your view, practitioner's view, on sanctions? When you seem to say that the industry was very sorry, that they would never do it again, and that we didn't really need criminal sanctions, or we wouldn't be seeing traders in orange jumpsuits being paraded down the road. That was unnecessary.
Did I say that?
I
don't think that I think what I said was that the participants are highly motivated to get this right, and I think people have looked at the behaviors over the last several years that we may be able to characterize as behaviors of a few individuals in the marketplace and rather than the behavior of the entire marketplace. And I think that that is something that has really driven the market to come together to say we need to make to ensure that we're running a market that is smooth for all participants. Again, when you look at the number of players in this global marketplace, it is truly unique. And to identify the fact that there has been bad behavior by a few but few notable participants, that's something that clearly the MPG is has identified and is working to change.
I mean, I would also, as when I answered the question earlier, which is we can't answer your question quite yet, in the sense of what the adherence mechanisms that Chris is going to propose, you know, we've got to work out what that is in terms of what we will recommend. But also,
not obviously you're in a position to outline specific sanctions, but I'm just trying to discern. The public is obviously very concerned that there's an industry out there that is reckless and is running wild, and speculating, and is destabilizing the world economy. And you seem to say that the impression I'm getting is that with the code of conduct, everything's going to be fine, because everyone's on board, everyone wants to be nice, and everyone's decent game.
Sure.
As you know, in the UK context, and it's clear when the FEMA publication came out in the summer, that the UK government said it will extend the market abuse regime to cover Spot FX, and it will do that in the context of newly agreed global code, and that's a decision for the UK government to make. This group here doesn't have any legislative powers or responsibilities. We've been asked to develop a global code and think about mechanisms to maximise adherence to that code, and it's for different governments and regimes to decide what else they want to do around that, and the UK government's made its position very clear.
Yeah, we've also obviously got to be cognizant of the regimes which are in place in the different jurisdictions, and as I said, most of us are not regulators. So I don't think... So there are, we've got to be aware of that. So it's that our task, I suppose, is more, those regimes are there in the different countries and they do what they do. What we're being tasked with is coming up with this code and trying to come up with mechanisms to get people to follow it. The reason why we're here is because of the quite obvious shortfall in behaviour that has occurred, and that the market does need to get to a better place. So. Everyone has got that shared vision to try and get it to that better place. We would hope that we can succeed. So we're aware of the situation at the moment and it needs to improve, and we've got to try and come up with ways to incentivize that improvement to occur.
And as you highlight, I mean, the foreign exchange market is very much viewed as it is part of monetary policy. It is part of the smooth functioning of economies around the world. Everything that we're working towards today is to help that market function more effectively in the future than it has in the past.
Okay, in the second row, please go ahead. Have you got a question? Oh, sorry, no, in the back row. Thank you.
You mentioned that this is going to be an evolving code, and you've mentioned a lot about technology and how this has changed the market structure. I'm just wondering, from your perspective, how do you see the evolution coming forward? And also, as it becomes more decentralized, if you're controlling the wholesale market effectively, is that enough control if it's becoming more decentralized?
We actually. I don't think we're controlling things, is he? But the code is going to have to evolve as the market structure evolves. So we're dealing with the market structure we've got at the moment. I'm not sure I can forecast how it's going to evolve in the future. We've clearly seen some trends which are probably likely to continue over the last few years towards. There's some decentralization. There's also probably, I would say, being some more centralization in other aspects of the market. In some areas, it's more concentrated.
Internalization
in particular. So I'm not sure I can forecast how it's going to go from here. But we've got to take the structure it is at the moment. But then, as I said earlier on, as the market structure evolves, the code has got to evolve to make sure it remains relevant for the structure of that market.
So part of what we'll do is, and a guy made this clear, there'll be a process in place to evolve the code after May 2017, and it's got to be respectful for the changes in market structure. We just don't know what those are going to be.
Okay, in the second round, go ahead.
Just back to the agreements issue, given that there's been worked on legislation in the UK and possibly other jurisdictions, is your work on how best to make a deal to make the deal to code or incentivize them go by best practice? Because there would have been a period of time when that's already been implemented. And if so, would there be any efforts in the UK rather than other jurisdictions which are doing things which you are looking at?
I think one way of answering your question, and one of the things early tasks we have on the adherence work stream, is to fully understand how the different national codes sit within the regulatory regime of different jurisdictions, and how we can take account of that when we move to a single code so it works across different jurisdictional structures. And that's something we need to work through, so it works in the UK, it works in Mexico, it works wherever, it works across many different jurisdictional contexts. And that's one of the early challenges that we have.
Any further
questions? I wanted to go back to a bit to the technicalities of that. So you mentioned high frequency trading, the changes in the market structure. This was also kind of in a way discussed when we had the Swiss National Bank decision of losses in effects and retail effects, which is another area. Are you looking to kind of get this code across the retail industry as well? Are you in touch with smaller platforms? And how do you think HFT and changes in the industry are also affecting you? Well, not even liquidity, but just
FX. Yeah, so I mean, there will be aspects which will certainly cover off on a number of those things that you just talked about. So, you know, we mentioned platforms earlier, so there'll be sort of principles around appropriate behavior platforms, you know, that, or, you know, best practice at on platforms, which will touch on a number of the issues that you're talking about there. As we said earlier, I mean, it is intending to cover all market participants, be they high frequency or low frequency traders. So I would envisage that we're certainly covering off on that as well. I mean, in terms of retail, at the very, I mean, some aspects it will be covered, but in some areas and in a number of jurisdictions, it's effectively covered under consumer protection law, and so we've, you know, got to be mindful of that. I mean, that was one area we actually had a reasonable discussion on yesterday, as to the extent how far we go down that route, I suppose, on the retail side. Because, as I said, in a number of jurisdictions, it's very much, a lot of it is covered under the sort of relevant consumer protection law.
The issue is, where does wholesale start and retail start?
Yeah.
And that varies somewhat across the jurisdictions involved, so we're trying to make sure we get that right.
Yeah,
but this is a code for the wholesale market.
Yeah, primarily aimed at the wholesale market, but obviously, you know, that, as Simon said, the delineation is not black and white.
Chief.
Just pick up something Chris mentioned. Much contingent on the serious different governments take on this code as far as sanctions and all that. Is there going to be any peer review of regulators on how they supervise this code? We see in the FSB the naming and shaming, the red line to. Is there anything like that going to be checking that?
Again, I don't know yet today. I mean, that's a possibility that it would be, we certainly could consider. We actually think we've even flagged it as a possibility to consider. So, but in the end, as I said, we're not the securities regulators, but so we can only propose things, but they can't.
So this is not regulation?
No.
It's not a substitute for it? It's supposed to complement the regimes that countries have?
Yeah, I mean, so this is, you know, it's principles-based code, not a regulatory code, because most of us in the group coming from the central banks don't have those regulatory powers. So, as I said, we're coming up with something which is very much principles-based. How each individual regime may then want to embed it, to picking up on what Chris said, within their own regulatory regime is,
yeah. And you foresee some countries putting into hard law, or kind of the EU directive or whatever?
I don't know. I mean, possibly. I mean, you know, I think, you know, if you were to take that.
I don't think it's sensible to kind of prejudge where this comes out. But this issue exists already in every jurisdiction about where the regulatory boundary ends and where voluntary codes of conduct start. And the creation of a global code doesn't change that problem or that relationship in any way, and that boundary is one that the authorities nationally have a kind of constant obligation to keep under review. And if we come up with a new global code, it is for the relevant competent authorities to make those judgments. It's important to recognize the limits of what our authority is here. We are authorized under the BIS governors to come up with a global code and think about mechanisms to support adherence. We are not regulators, and we don't have that ambit or authority.
Okay, go ahead, Stephanie.
Just on this point of your overall mandate, I mean, there's been a lot of focus since the scandal about the fact about the kind of light touch regulation in FX, in the sense that banks may be regulated, but the products are not regulated as they are in other markets. Can you just talk a little bit about why you think this approach might be, is or might be preferable? If they were to have, if you were to have had a mandate, or regulators were to have been given a mandate to actually come up with a set of rules, that would presumably remove the need to find kind of the ways to incentivize adherence to coastal sanctuaries.
So I'll just reiterate what Chris just said. Our work is complementary to whatever regulatory changes may be. It's not a substitute, it's a complement. So I wouldn't frame it, which I think would interpret your question more. It's an either-or decision. I would regard what we're doing as a complement to whatever other regulatory changes individual jurisdictions may come up with. I don't think it's an either-or choice.
Time for a few more. Go ahead.
You might follow up on FX Week. This might be a bit of a cheeky question, but will the central banks adhere to the code as well?
I was waiting for that question. No, that's not the answer I was actually going to give. I'd say where applicable, our expectation is that central banks would adhere to the code. I can speak for my central bank, and the answer is we would be adhering to the code.
So in New York, on our trading desk, we have a long history of conforming with the code throughout there, and we'd expect that to be the case here. Sometimes the central bank will deviate just a little bit because it's a central bank and it's viewed as a different kind of counterpart to a private sector counterpart. Yeah. But this is supposed to be for all market participants, and central banks can be big participants in the wholesale market.
So, I mean, for instance, we had followed the ACI code in Australia, and that includes us, the Reserve Bank, for instance. So, yes, that is the expectation.
At the end of the row.
Hi, I'm Alice Atwood from FRW. You've mentioned ACI a few times. Obviously, the model code, especially in London, is seen as something that is worth following, and it's something that's been invested into, a lot of time and effort has gone into producing new updates, that kind of thing. How will a global code affect the role of ACI? Do you expect members to start adhering to the global code through ACI membership, or does this sort of make ACI obsolete?
Marshall Bailey, the head of ACI, is on the market participants group, so that gives you some indication that ACI is a participant in this process. But as we said, the code will subsume the ACI code as it does the other five codes which are out there. In terms of the adherence mechanism, what you just said, it would be a possibility, one way of demonstrating adherence. So, as I said, ACI is very much involved in this process. I mean, as I said, in Australia, we use the ACI code. In Euro area, they use the ACI code currently. And in both cases, we will, once the global code is there, we will follow that. But so ACI is participating in this process, and they're well aware, well aware of it. I mean, that's certainly an active participant in the process.
Time for a couple more. Any further questions? Great.
Sorry, I didn't want to introduce myself earlier. Dan Hindry, Central Banking. I just wanted to ask quickly, you mentioned there's some kind of grey areas of the code where people aren't quite clear where it works and how to apply it. Can you give any examples of that?
So, of the existing code, I mean, I think the most obvious one is the one I've already said a few times, which is trading as principal versus agent. And there are many manifestations of that, but if you want to sum it up into one, that's probably the most succinct way of describing it, in that that's where there is less understanding about what is the appropriate behaviour around
that. That becomes more relevant if it's applying to all participants in the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one would logically look at this and say the evolution of the agency role in the market is clearly something that has been born out of the events of the last 4 or 5 years. There have been agents in the market in the past, but it's a more well-defined category today than it's been. And bringing more clarity to the role will certainly be helpful to the end user as well as to those who are providing pricing.
So to come back to something that we were talking about earlier, the FX benchmark stuff, so you want to look at the evolution. There's been a marked evolution since, the fixed window was widened in February in terms of the agency participation in the flow through that window. So the bank offering now is very much an agency offering, not always, but very much much larger share of that execution going through that. The 5-minute window now at 4 p.m. is effectively agency flow rather than principal flow, and that's changed dramatically in the past sort of 6 or 9 months.
Can you explain that, like, to be more simple, what you just said?
So I provide a mechanism for your fixing order basically to be executed in the market, but I'm not taking the risk necessarily onto my own book, I suppose. If that,
it's going to change after you widen the window.
Yeah. So if you look at the offering that a lot of institutions provide, it's basically it's algorithmic execution through the windows. We've certainly seen the share of algo execution in that 5-minute window has gone up dramatically from what it was in the earlier, the previous 1-minute window.
Okay, in the background, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, what specifically about the previous codes weren't you kind of outlined some of the points, but why is the answer to have a new global code as opposed to revisiting what is already out there?
So I think it's really just coming up with one code for the whole industry. So, I mean, we are revisiting what's already out there, and since the starting point we've got is the 6 codes, and we are taking what's there, identifying the gaps in terms of what isn't there and filling them in. But in that process, rather than doing that 6 times over in a not necessarily consistent way, we're reflecting the fact that the market is very much a global market by just having the one single global code. So it is building on what is already there, as we said, and filling in the identifiable gaps.
I think the process started in 2013 when a preamble was set up which went through all of the codes that the 8 major FXCs adopted. And despite, even if we hadn't had the scandals, I think over time, the natural place to get an FX would have been one single code. What's happened is the urgency of doing that, because we can make the code stronger, make it clearer how to get adherence to the code, Chris's work, is there now. And that's why, even though it, for some people, May 2017 seems a long way away, in this kind of world, that's actually a very quick deadline.
In the background, I've got a question.
I'm wondering, just following on from your comments about the ASA, if there's anything else you can add specifically about what needs to the Australian market.
That's nothing different than what it means for any other market participant, I don't think. I mean, it's not, none of it is particularly, the FX market is very much a global market. Nationality of participants by and large is close to irrelevant. And so this is very much something which is directed across the market as a whole, and something which is usable by markets participants regardless of where you actually happen to be sitting, and it's appropriate for market participants regardless. And to some extent, that reflects why the question earlier about why are we subsuming all the 8 different or 6 different codes into one is, in the end, there really aren't material differences between the markets. It's the odd local idiosyncrasy here or there, which will still need to be reflected. But by and large, it is one market, it's one global market, and hence it's appropriate that all the market participants are following the same standards of good practice.
Okay, we'll wrap up. So there will be a recording available shortly on the RBA website should you wish to check back or clarify anything that's been said. The Wi-Fi codes, should you wish to use our network to file anything, at the back of the table by the remaining bacon rolls. And finally, thank you very much for coming. Really appreciate your time.
Can I just add, one more thing to it. As I said, this is, I appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk to you all. I do come to London a reasonable amount, but it's useful to be able to have this opportunity. But please, if you have any further questions, we're not disappearing into a dark room and re-emerging in 18 months' time. If you do have any questions, I'm very happy for you to get in touch and ask, and try and do my best to answer them. So I appreciate the opportunity of the economies of scale of talking to everyone at once, and with all 4 of us here. But I'd also, if you have any further questions, I'm very happy to try and do my best to answer them in the future, not necessarily on the phone in the middle of the night, but but certainly I'm happy to arrange ways of being in contact in the future.
Thank you all. Thank you very much.